You're listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
Hello, this is Colin Waters here of the Scottish Poetry Library. I'm currently sitting on a train that's travelling out of Glasgow to Helensburgh, where I'm going to meet the poet Jerry Luce. Jerry's just about to publish a book called Fault Line, which is a collection of interconnected poems about Faslane, about the area around Faslane, which is, I suppose you'd call it, the site of Scotland's nuclear deterrent, or Britain's nuclear deterrent. It's where nuclear missiles are kept. The Trident programme is located there, which in the event of a nuclear war would be where the submarines that carry Britain's nukes would depart from to fire off their weapons of mass destruction. As you can maybe tell, I'm not a military expert. Perhaps Jerry can fill us in more on how the actual deterrent would work. I'm sitting in a train, as I say, and we're moving away from Glasgow, and as we do, the landscape's shedding its elements of city and we're heading into the countryside. So the next time we speak, I should be talking to Jerry, and Jerry will be filling us in on the genesis of his new collection, Fault Line. Here I am now in a car, Jerry Luce's car, driving out of Helensburgh. Hello, Jerry.
Hello, Colin. Good morning.
Good morning. Where are we going, Jerry?
We are going probably first off to Rue, which is the direction we're heading in, to stop off at the Chandlery there, and then we'll go on to Faslane, and then up into Glenfruin, where you get splendid, quite high up views of the whole development of Faslane, but also it's back up onto the moor and it's very beautiful up there in that glen and above it.
So where are we now, Jerry? How would you describe this? You're the poet.
Well, this is Rue Marina, which is somewhere between Helensburgh and it's just on the outskirts of Helensburgh. That everybody considers it a separate place, and it's on route to Faslane. As you can see, there's dozens and dozens of pleasure craft moored here. It is a marina. There's no working harbour or anything here, and this kind of boat has supplanted the fishing boats that used to be here. You know, not that long ago, all gone now. Every last one of them, and with them, the people who knew these waters really, really well, and because they fished them, they had special names for them, which have all gone as well.
And how does that figure in Fault Line?
You know, wherever you go, you sort of scratch the surface around here, and somebody knows somebody who knows you, or somebody knows somebody who knows of you, or somebody thinks they know somebody who knows of you. But also the kind of languages. Part of the notion of the poem is it's one of loss, as well as geopolitics and the fauna and the flora of the region. It's the people who keep cropping up in it. The kind of languages that have been lost here and the languages that are spoken. Nobody uses those fishermen's terms anymore, and before that there was the loss of the Gaelic in these parts, last remnants of it probably in Tarbert now, which is really very close by sea.
Are you going to read us a section inspired by this?
I'll just read something. Obviously the poem is quite a long one, it's lots and lots of sections, but it runs throughout the year, so this one is not necessarily appropriate in terms of the weather we're having today, which is quite balmy, given that just a mile up there over Ben Bui, you can't see Ben Bui because it's covered in cloud and it's looking grey and pretty ominous, really, in terms of us staying dry for this morning at least. Old men greet me, a nod and a smile in Helensburgh. The Chandler of Rue is an old friend of an old friend, we think. They cannot know my heart. Now, water under thin scabs, ice crusts, Fox and I look for retreat, neither able to walk on water any longer. Fox walks through wood, crows sit on ice floating rocks, tilt heads in contemplation, sip running water. One of the pleasures, turning on water.
So maybe this is a good opportunity, actually, to talk about the structure of the poem and how it actually works. Is it one poem, Jerry? Is it an epic, or is it a series of interconnected poems?
one of the driving forces was that I wanted to write about something that's really absolutely in my own backyard. After having written about atomic sites and walked in them in American deserts and in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, we're just tomorrow, actually, the 9th of August, is the commemoration of Nagasaki and the day the atomic bomb was dropped there. And just down the road here is Fast Lane with nuclear weapons infinitely more powerful than anything that was ever dropped in anger over Hiroshima, Nagasaki. And I just found myself walking around here, getting to know the place really quite intimately. And I started writing and poems started coming. They were all linked together. And I reached quite a number and I thought, well, I have to stop somewhere, but I couldn't stop. So I paired what was coming next with the first one I'd written and then with the second and third and so on. And they seem to form a kind of fault line, because Fast Lane itself is set on the Highland Fault Line, or one of the Highland Fault Lines. So the poem does a kind of sort of Möbius strip. It's a kind of loop from beginning to end, and the themes run through it. But each poem can be read separately, but also each poem is in two halves. And together there's 100 or so of them, and they form a complete long, I wouldn't call it epic, but it's a long connected sequence.
And fault line, for non-geological people like myself, it's a sort of geological term, but obviously there's a metaphorical aspect to it as well.
Well, yeah, it's a metaphorical aspect to it, but it's literally a place where, you know, there's been an upthrust or a downthrust of rock at some point in geological time. But these places are geologically unstable to this day across the world. They're sort of, you know, everybody's heard of tectonic plates. They're a bit like that, where land masses, kind of the same one in the case of this Highland Fault Line, kind of butt up against each other, and you know, they're still geologically unstable, and there are still rumbles to this day in parts of Argyll that will be recorded pretty low on the Richter scale, but you know, they're there, and it doesn't make any sense literally to cite something like this, albeit underwater mostly, on a geological fault line. And the metaphorical side of it is, I'm kind of reflecting that folly, in my opinion. I mean, it's folly to have them here in the first instance. Everybody's probably aware of that. It's, you know, how long is it since Britain has been, and I use the term advisedly, kidding itself that it's a major superpower and bankrupting the entire set of people who live on these islands, you know, whatever their original nationality.
Well, here we are actually at Fast Lane, would you believe, the site of the UK's nuclear deterrent, or where they keep the nuclear deterrent before sending out on its submarine patrols. That's fair to say, isn't it? Oh, yes, we're in the car park here, actually. There's signs up saying car parked, owners on risk. Jerry suggested that's because, you know, your car could get nuked, basically. And it's really quite beautiful, actually. You can see the landscape, the greenery, the sea, and then you turn around and you see the actual base, and it's unbelievable amount of barbed wire, cameras, men in security jackets, vests. It's really quite strange. So you come here quite often, do you, Jerry?
Only when it's necessary to come here. I mean, if you just look out over the other side there, that the Rosneath Peninsula, it's beautiful. It's Argyll. It's, you know, a few houses on the shoreline, more deciduous trees, and as you were indicating, turn around this side, this way, facing the opposite direction, and it's like, it's a nuclear submarine repository site, and that, by the way, is far, far worse than barbed wire. It's razor wire. You know, you just practically need to look at it, and it snakes you. Cuts you very badly, and there's mile upon mile upon mile of it, because it's about 8 or 10 rolls deep, quite apart from the two that are on top of the fence, so you don't stand a chance of getting in there, except of course by sea. And the strangest people have come here and got in actually to very close to the submarines and sat on them and painted things on them over the years, and I think that's a wee Navy pilot boat just chugging around, making sure that there are no No unauthorised boats too close.
Well, as we were driving up here, we passed the vigil camp that they have a sign up that says no more Hiroshimas, however you want to pronounce that. And Jerry, you were mentioning it wasn't impossible that, you know, a police car might drive by just to remind us, you know, that that this is a nuclear base and we shouldn't take liberties and whatnot. So maybe it's a nice moment to read some poetry.
Sure, yeah. It's always a good defence against realpolitik. It's kind of, in a sense, looking out over to the Rosneath Peninsula, which just the other side, by the way, is, you know, another military installation. About right for these parts, mostly birch, some oak, my living room, where the white hind has scented me, though I'm glassed in standard class on the halted train through Glen Douglas. She follows my gaze over her shoulder to hillside bunkers, trots downwind in the direction of the sea's drifting foam specks. Fast lane. While an owl edits my sleep. An object.
I wanted to ask you about the style of Fault Line. It's quite lyrical in parts, but you haven't gone for a Wordsworthian lushness. It's almost sort of like, I suppose, photo images, snaps, are sort of edited together. What was your thinking? How did you put it together, Jerry?
That's a hell of a question.
I've nuked you with that question.
You certainly hit me below the waterline, that's for sure. Okay, so this is 2014. I started kind of working on this some years ago now. Kind of language that Wordsworth used, although arguably we're seeing some of the same scenery and scenarios. His sister walked in these parts in 1803 or 1804 and wrote about it. And back then, for example, she could find hardly any English speakers. Everybody was speaking Gaelic in these parts. The language has evolved, the language has changed. We've all become more attentive, arguably, towards language, but also to the way things are presented. The latter half of the 20th century, the great sort of experimenters were fragmenting things, cutting them up like William Burroughs. And it seems that the use of language has both grown and deteriorated, dwindled in some ways. Yes, of course, I can wax lyrical, to use that awful phrase, about what we're seeing over that side, but it would only be half the picture if I ignored what's right behind us and what the possibilities of this landscape now are. Mm. I mean, it's dominated by Faslane for miles around. If something happened, most of the west of Scotland would be gone, and there's no ignoring that. So it determined that there would be some new way of expressing both sides, you know, everything. I'm not judgmental in this. I'm a very judgmental person about Faslane. But the poem, if you read it carefully, you'll find there are no judgments made, merely observations. That's very much what I wanted to do. I wanted to present stuff and people can make up their own minds. If they find lyricism in it, wonderful. If they find politics in it, great. If they find traces of things gone by, then that's there as well. But also the here and now, the very much here and now. It's very solid. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of stuff lying about here.
Jerry just kicked a traffic cone, folks.
Sorry.
Now that we've raised the subject of nature poetry, I think we often forget Wordsworth and Coleridge, and before those two, Burns, when they're writing about the countryside, they weren't writing in a neutral, isn't it nice, nature as a sort of healing balm. Variety of poetry. I guess 200 years has kind of dulled us to the fact that they were in actual fact political radicals. They had a very definite take on landscape and nature. It wasn't just meant to lull the reader with the nice sounds, was it? And I would argue, Jerry, that your poetry, although the style is different from what those guys were doing, it's definitely in the tradition of the radical romanticism of a couple of centuries earlier.
Wordsworth was a revolutionary, you know. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. I mean, he was over in France. He saw what could happen, and he was appalled by some of the things which have appalled many thinking people, men and women, throughout over those centuries. Things like John Clare was appalled by the Enclosure Act. Wordsworth was really, really irritated by land ownership and the patterns of feudalism which were then existing, and which we can still see today to a very high degree in Scotland. patterns of land ownership don't change very much here in these islands, with the certain exception of Ireland, parts of it, which is happily a republic, and people are in... there's a bobbin eider duck just there. I love these creatures. It might say something to us in a minute. Yeah, I mean, you cannot be alive in the 21st century and not be aware of the way the land has changed. And if you start scratching the surface, you get deeper and deeper and deeper beneath the surface of the root causes of the troubles in the world, not just here in Scotland. Land and water and the possession, legal, moral or otherwise, leading to disputes all over. Other people can write what they write. I cannot but help including that kind of thing in what I do and what I write. It's part of me. It would be being false to me if I were to write in the way that Wordsworth might have written in his latter years.
And it's not a esoteric debate or point. I mean, just the other day there, I was watching the first of the debates between the sort of yes and no campaign here in Scotland over the subject of independence, Alex Salmond versus Alistair Darling. And the subject of Fastlane came up during that. SNP and I think people who are on the yes to independence side are all very much strongly in favour of getting rid of this place, shutting it down. So, you know, writing a poem about it is actually putting your finger very much on the pulse of what's happening now in Scotland politically.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that you know, I'd like to say a planned referendum, but I can't.
It's amazing promotional work, Jerry. Well done.
But you know, there's a very interesting thing. Years and years and years ago, I used to live just in that direction over there, behind that hill, a place called Glendaruel. And Glendaruel is the sort of town there nearest is Dunoon. And by Dunoon, everybody knows is Holyloch. And I wrote a long-ish poem many years ago about Holyloch. In some ways, I guess, the precursor to this poem, Faultline. Within 2 years, the entire US Navy presence had disappeared from Holyloch. So, you know, I'm actually hoping the same thing might happen. To 2016-17, Fastlane might just depart.
So your poem could be almost like a spell, trying to set some sort of charm upon this area.
Yeah, obviously it's a fanciful thought, but it's a good thought. It's a heartwarming thought for me.
Well, here we are now on a hill overlooking Fastlane itself. It's weirdly beautiful, you know. We're sitting on this hill and there's sheep and the sun's trying its darndest to get through the clouds. You can feel a little bit of heat and there's breeze. On the other side, there's the beautiful hills. It's a lovely spot, but just at the bottom of the hill, there's Fastlane itself, which is not lovely to look at. There's cranes and warehouse, cuboid, ugly, slightly rusty looking warehouse where who knows what fun goes on in there. And I'm sitting here with Jerry, and I mean, what do you make of the view, Jerry?
If you hold your hand up to the lower part of the view, it's sublime over there to the hills, to Araher and beyond. And if you then take your hand away, it's, as you pointed out, it's functional concrete and steel buildings, derricks, cranes, a big sort of boom arrangement to prevent unauthorised vessels, boats passing too close to it. And what actually goes on in the big, big shed there, you can see the steel shed, is it's just big enough to take one submarine at a time to be worked on. It's a kind of dry dock. If you're lucky or misfortunate, depending on your point of view, you'll see them coming and going. A view is a view. A view changes. This will change as well.
And when you were driving up here, we were just saying, you know, Fastlane is a... Now notorious or famous for being the site of a nuclear submarine base, but it was a name that existed long before that. And it's curious the way that, you know, names get charged with these sort of meanings that they never originally had. They get hijacked, I suppose.
Yeah, they get hijacked and they become associated with something, usually something unpleasant, like a battle, or we were saying, you know, Bannockburn, or they become associated with a terrible, terrible tragedy, which, you know, brings to mind Nagasaki, Hiroshima. But this place, Faslane, there used to be a wee burial ground down there, an early Celtic Christian burial. These who seem to swarm all along these waters, Irish sort of travelling exiled, self-exiled saints, and they would land up and they'd found a little cell for themselves, a little church. And Faslane is actually the burial place of St. Ninian, among others. One of the St. Ninians, there's been quite a few.
Shall we have some more poetry, Jerry?
Yeah, well, but behind us, we're on the height just before we descend into Glenfruin, and I suppose that little preamble kind of fits this poem into its place. Once he was a bishop, once too a boy, Donner in Glenfruin, a place. Not us, not even our view of us, declining cockroach, but yellow star petals fallen on concrete and tender every year, Aeolus tenderly binding, not us, world.
One of the things that I really like about Faultline is the way in which it's almost as if the base itself is starting to sort of poison the language or the way that we look at the world. There's a line about a wooden enemy looking like a split bullet, and there's other sort of metaphors and choices of language that people talk about, nuclear radiation and radation poisoning, but in a sense this is almost linguistic poisoning, isn't it? It affects how you're looking at this world.
It has to affect how you're looking at the world. I mean, I deal with words. I'm a poet. That's one of the things I do. So the pollution, yeah, it's not too strong a word, from a sort of linguistic, a military linguistic fallout is very, very apparent to me. And you start to think in these terms. You look at, I mean, we're looking at Tormentil. There's Tormentil right in front of us. Beautiful little plant. Yellow cruciform shape. And then you think, well, cruciform, you know, you begin to get into these notions of horrible notions of what men, usually men, do to other men on the planet in the shape of a cross for one belief or another, for one misguided conception of power. And the abuse of language is the first step towards controlling other people. It's the first, if you control the language, as folk here know only too well, Gaelic has disappeared. It was kind of not quite outlawed, but it was frowned upon, and then people began to think that it wouldn't do you any good because English is the dominant language. And then, you know, the Scots terms as well disappear because there are so many people who are not necessarily Scots working on the Faslane base. And then military terminology, you know, the sort of creep, the way the military uses syntax and language itself, words themselves and verbs, to hide behind, to use as a screen, to accustom us to the fact that we can't do something, basically, that we don't own something, that we are prohibited. This really concerns me, because it's one of the very first steps of control.
We're on our next stop of our journey. We're just off a MOD road where what looked like a commander in a very natty red Mini drove past. We've clambered up a bit of a slope. And where are we now, Jerry?
We're at a sort of memorial, a commemorative stone, and I'll just read it to you because it's very short, just to kind of illustrate the fact that this place hasn't always been the peaceful little Highland Glen that you might, West Highland Glen that you might think it is. It's, you know, it was ever the way, but it reads in its entirety, "Near this spot, the Battle of Glenfruin was fought between Clan Cahoon and Clan Gregor on the 7th of February, 1603. There's a lot of missing information there. The Cahoons were in the pay of the Campbells, and the Gregors were outnumbered hugely by the Cahoons and various others. But they managed to rout them, but it was possibly the Gregors did. But it was possibly the start of the outright theft of all the Gregors' lands, which had been taking part piecemeal, the outlawing of the Gregors, the banishment of them, an entire clan, the entire Gríodach. and it was legal for a point to take the heads or to brand the women. Obviously, all their cattle were forfeit along with the lands. And so they were, for very many, many, many years, they were banished people, internal banishment.
And this is really the only sign of these terrible dramas 400 years ago now. The countryside otherwise looks, well, when we're not looking at nuclear military bases, looks quite nice and peaceful. But no, here we are against a sort of monument that reminds us of the terrible human history here.
Absolutely. 400 years ago, you know, nothing much changes, does it? Just the weaponry. You know, you'd have to sort of... You'd have to be a bit bolder to go at somebody with a broadsword or whatever, you know, to personally take a life, and here it's the pressing of a button.
Exactly. Shall we have some more poetry now, Jerry?
Yeah, sure. We're looking out over along Glenfruin, and these are just some of the place names of this. I love this place. It's despite all of its, you know, quite horrible history and its terrible present day manifestations of military might, I love it because it's just, it's a completely unassuming and wonderful little glen, which, you know, in many ways just sort of is symptomatic of the whole west of Scotland. How clear shadow is, clearer than lined hand, than veined leaf, than hand bones held to shade eyes. Stolen expressions of existence. There is one whose name is lost, Harshin, the crosswise hill, and Achungaik, Hurach, hill of the Fank, Mylan Feig, bleak hill of the deer, the dappled hill, Craig Maddy, little crag of the fox, and the lookout hill of the sheeling. Here's the stony hill, the high cracked hill, the red hill, and the black hill crowding litter of the shoreline, Coolport, and Faslane, the homestead of sorrows.
Well, we've been exercising our right to roam by walking along a MOD road, and now we're exercising our right to podcast by maybe recording another poem at the end of this road here. What are we looking at, by the way, Jerry?
Well, we're looking at a big signpost, Bylaws 1987, Defence Statutory Instruments, number 1761, the Glenfruin Road Bylaws. They came in force in the same year, and just a wee extract. Enforcement. The following persons are hereby authorised to remove from the protected area, it's military, not conservation protection, and, if it is in the interests of justice to do so, to take into custody without warrant any person committing an offence against any of the preceding bylaws, and remove them from such areas, remove from such areas any vehicles, animals, aircraft, or anything whatsoever found therein in contravention of these bylaws. A. The Commander-in-Chief, Naval Home Command. B. The Flag Officer, Scotland and Northern Ireland. C. The Commodore, Clyde, and so on and so forth. So basically, anybody connected with the military can have you. You know, it's this kind of thing which, in part, because it's an overwhelming presence here, led to the making of this poem. It's not entirely about the military, it's about all the other things that are in the West Highlands here.
As we approach the sign, I did think it looked like a kind of explosive symbol on it. And what does it say, Jerry?
Well, the top one is a little triangular image of three guys in combat gear carrying guns, warning troops training.
It's kind of cute. It almost from a distance looks like school kids crossing a road, but it's not as soldiers.
Yeah. And the next one is clearly an explosion, and it says, warning, do not touch suspicious objects. And the final one is an exclamation point, you see? We're talking... We might as well talk about punctuation as well as the subversion of language. It's an exclamation point, and it says, warning, sudden noise, smoke or illumination possible. Now, that's metaphorical, if I've ever I heard it, you know? The illumination of what? Manuscripts or artistic endeavour? But I don't think they mean that. I think they just mean it's going to get lit up with flares.
Also, the if we want to, you know, practice a bit of art criticism here. The middle one, that's the explosive one, it actually almost, it's a circular thing that's blowing up. It's almost like a planet blowing up, isn't it?
It is. Oh, very well spotted. Yeah, yeah.
Is illumination possible now from some poetry, Jerry?
I'm not entirely sure of that, but this one is relevant, perhaps. And it refers to other overseas military endeavours which were current at the time of writing and still are. Lately made of flesh and blood, in Operation Herrick, the Major tells us how remarkably this irrigation system so closely resembles that of the valley of the River H, and straw and manure, and here's a number of the A diaspora too. What's the dance we are left with? After hours whiskey. What's the song bequeathed? A red rose. Then, he says, salmon in a tin. Venison on butcher slab. What's the ground we're left with? Bracken and ragwort. Nightshade.
Well, we're going to do one more poem for the road, and we're on the side of a road right now. You can maybe hear the occasional baa of a sheep, the roar of a jet engine overhead. There's chaps working on the electricity pylons. So for a quiet nook, it can be quite noisy, actually. But now we're going to change the sound by having some melodic words from Jerry, some poetry, to sort of settle the scene. And what have you got for us, Jerry?
It's another watery one about water, but there's a bit of a bite to it, perhaps. The ocean's oracle, trident. Unspilling to under this firth bridge, starling clouds together, dispersing night after seasons, years, again, treatise worlded.
Downloading this Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter at By Leaves We Live, and find us on Facebook.